The Parsha Vayigash begins in a state of high tension. We did not have a shir in Parshas Miketz, but I'm sure you were following current events. And nobody knows what to do anymore. The brothers are thoroughly confused, confounded by this Egyptian ruler. And in the final act of desperation, perhaps, Yehuda, of all of the brothers, he undertook a guarantorship of Binyamin. He approaches the bench. Vayigash elav Yehuda, vayomer bi aduni. Yehuda approaches and says, please, yedaber na abdecha dovar bosni aduni. Please let me just speak to you. Ki chamocha kafar. Before we get into the pshat and parshanut discussions of the beginning of Vayigash, we should know that the very first word of the parsha has an impact on our Jewish practice every day, more than once. How so? If we begin by referring to what we know from Hilchos Tefillah, that before we begin the Shmona Esrei, and the crystallization of Tefillah, of course, is the Shmona Esrei, before we begin the Shmona Esrei, we take three steps forward. And after we conclude the Shmona Esrei, we take three steps backwards. And that seems to be a very symmetrical situation. However, we should know that the origins of these two sets of three steps are not the same. Actually, of the two steps, only one of them is mentioned in the Talmud, and the other is not to be found in the Talmud, or the Rambam, or even the Shulchan Aruch. If we begin with the set that is mentioned, the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, Daf Nun Gimel Amud Beis. It isn't even discussed in Maseches Brachos, where the halachos of Tefillah are discussed, but rather within the context of the Gemara's discussion of how the Kohen Gadol used to bow out of the Kodesh HaKodoshim. That is the way a person is to take leave of the Beis HaMikdash. And within the context of that discussion, the Gemara says that is the way a person has to take leave of his Tefillah. He needs to bow out of the Tefillah. Certainly, this resonates with the statement of Chazal in the fourth parak of Brachos that when a person is davening, should see himself as if he's in the Kodesh HaKodoshim. If that's true, then one leaves accordingly. And therefore, says the Talmud, a person needs to step backwards, and that is how you conclude. One takes leave of the Tefillah. And Ad Kedei Kach, the Talmud expresses itself that if a person davened and didn't take three steps backwards, it would be better had he not davened at all. Ad kedei kach. Because in a sense, it represents the fact that he has no appreciation of what he's just done. And this, of course, now is codified in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch after the Shmona Esrei. One takes three steps back. And it's also important, while we're mentioning it, not to step forward straight away. The Talmud has a few choice words to say about that as well. And so if a person takes three steps back and immediately steps forwards again, it sounds like he's dancing. You know, there's no concept of the fact that he's taken leave of Tefillah. He needs to wait there for a while before he then resumes his place. What about the three steps before the Shmona Esrei? Not a mention. Not in the Gemara, and as we said, not Rambam and Shulchan Aruch. So where does it come from? One of the Ashkenazi Rishonim was called Rabbi Eliezer Rokeach. And he wrote a Perush on the Torah, the Rokeach, and he's quoted extensively. And the Rokeach says that the word Vayigash, if you look in the Medrash, and the translation of Vayigash, of course, the Pshat is, he approached, Lageshet, Vayigash. The Medrash says that the Lashon of Vayigash is a Lashon of Tefillah, which means aside from everything else that Yehuda was doing, and he was doing lots of things as he was approaching Yosef, he's also davening, says the Medrash. Ein vayigash el loshen tefillah. And moreover, says the Rokeach, the expression of vayigash as a prelude to prayer is something that we find three times in the Tanakh. The first time, actually, we have already had, because it's in Parshas Vayera, as Avram is about to daven for Sodom, Vayigash Avraham Vayomar, Ha'ach Tisbeh Tzadik Im Rasha, etc. The first Vayigash is overtly a prelude to Tefillah. The second time, says the Rokeach, is our Parsha, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, as the Medrash told us. And the third time is to be found in Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Ches, the famous showdown at Har Carmel between Eliyahu and the Nevi'ah Habal. Vahibalo Samincha, Vayigash Eliyahu, and that's the Aneini Hashem Aneini. So those are the three Vayigashes of Tefillah. And says the Rokeach, corresponding to those three words, Vayigash, we approach Tefillah with the three steps. That's where it comes from. The three approaches are the three times of Vayigash. And therefore, in terms of, shall we say, mainstream halacha, the first mention of this minhag is to be found, we said, not in the Shulchan Aruch, that is to say, not in Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch, but in the Ramah, in the Ramah's glosses, because that's the job of the Ramah. It's an Ashkenazi minhag. The Rokeach is of Ashkenaz. And the Ramah adds in his Hagohos all of the Ashkenazi editions where the Minhagim diverge. And therefore the first you will see of it is in the Ramah in Hilchos Tefillah. What's interesting is, if you look around nowadays, you will not, it's not like Kitnius. I mean, you won't see that there's a divide between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, as if to say that Ashkenazim, they will take three steps forward. But why would Sephardim do that? It's a universal minhag. How did that happen? So I believe the answer is very simple. We mentioned that the Rokeach is one of the Ashkenazi Rishonim. He is. But he, in addition to that, he belonged to a very specific circle of Ashkenazi Rishonim, which were called Chassidei Ashkenaz. Now, Chassidei Ashkenaz were a group of exceptionally holy and pious, possible to describe them really, but their entire lives were lives of Chassidus. Some of them, actually others we know by name, and some of them were called HaChassid. Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, the famous Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, who wrote the Sefer Chassidim, is of the Chassidei Ashkenaz. His father was Rabbeinu Shmuel HaChassid, and who is the author of Anim Zemiris. Chassidei Ashkenaz, in addition to their Chassidish practices of Chassidus, I shouldn't say Chassidish, that was hundreds of years yet to come, but they were also steeped in Kabbalah. And if you've ever perused Anim Zemiris, which is what we have from Rabbi Shmuel HaChassid, so you see it's Kabbalah from beginning to end, which is why little children say it at the end of Musaf. One could be Dorish Lishvach, that at least the child doesn't delude himself that he thinks he understands what the Anim Zemiris means. With grown-ups, you can't be sure. But in any event, because that is the case, so by and large, Ashkenazi Minhagim do not cross over to become Sephardi Minhagim. The Minhagim of Chassidei Ashkenaz will, because at a certain point in the 1500s, with the Arizal and his school, Kabbalah became a mainstay of Minhag Sfarad as well, and therefore it became a catalyst for a crossover of a number of Ashkenazi Minhagim that are based in Kabbalah, and before you know it, they become Sfardi Minhagim as well. And moreover, Al Derech HaKabbalah, the Sfardi Poskim and Gedolim begin to elaborate on these Minhagim even further. So that's a very interesting, it's not known to that many people, but we literally step into Tefillah based on the Rokeach's understanding of the threefold repetition of Vayigash in the Tanakh. So that is a word from the world of Minhag and Halacha. But as we come to consider the Pasuk now, Al Derech HaPshat, and of course, the questions are there in front of us. Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda asks, Yidaber na avdecha davar ba'aznei Adonai. I would like to speak, literally we translate, in the ears of my master. Va'al yichar apcha ba'avdecha. Do not be angry at me, ki chamocha kefaro, because you're like Paro. Now, firstly, what is the meaning of this very specific phrase, davar ba'aznei Adonai? People hear through their ears. Anytime you speak to a person, you speak, your words go into their ears. What is the specific connotation of davar ba'aznei Adonai? And secondly, what does Yehuda mean by prefacing with the words ki chamocha kefaro? Which is interesting, because here, if we translate freely, we would say, you're like Paro. Actually, the pasuk doesn't say you're like Paro. It says literally, because like you, like Paro, which is a highly charged phrase. And Rashi gives four perushim as to what ki chamocha kefaro means. I'm not aware of any other place in the Chumash that Rashi gives four perushim. And there is yet room for others to comment. And the Rosh HaKodesh explains in his way. We understand from the Parsha that this encounter between the brothers and Yosef is not exclusively between him and them. There are others in the room. Yosef is a ruler. He has his entourage. And that actually could cause complications. And Yehuda needs to get rid of them before, or to sideline them before he begins to speak to Yosef. For the simple reason that he is about to accuse Yosef, essentially, at the very least, of a mistake, of a misunderstanding, and possibly worse. Now, says the Rosh HaKodesh, we should be aware, very illustrative, to consider a story that the Talmud tells us in Maseches Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Amud Beis, of a certain gentleman called Ketia Bar Shalom. Now, Ketia Bar Shalom was a court advisor, and the Roman ruler in Eretz Yisrael was considering a certain course of action. And Ketia Bar Shalom, I'm not sure if his job was officially that of an advisor, he happened to be there at the time, and he thought it was a bad idea, and he said so. He said, it's a mistake, the policy will not work, it will backfire, and it's unnecessary. And for all of these reasons, he submitted to the king that his idea was wrong. Well, did they take his advice? Yes, sound advice. But they came over to Ketia Bar Shalom and they said, everything you said is correct, so thank you very much. There's just one problem. You corrected the king. That means that you made the king emerge as mistaken. You are not allowed to do that, and therefore you are liable to be executed. And they killed him. So in other words, within the setting of the court, one cannot just expose the king's flaw. Because from a certain point of view, you can't afford to be right. Because if you are, you're finished. And if you lose, so there was no point. So you can't win. And the Rosh HaKodesh suggests that Yehuda is very conscious of this. He's about to accuse Yosef of willful manipulation. If it's done within the public setting of his entourage, so Yehuda fears for his life. And therefore he introduces by saying, if I may, Yidaber na avdecha davar ba'aznei Adonai. Ba'aznei Adonai means private session. This should not be publicly heard. Va'yichar avcha ba'avdecha. And please don't be angry with me for suggesting that. The reason why is ki chamocha kefaro. Because you're like Paro, meaning you're the type of person that I cannot afford to prove wrong in public if I wish to live, to return home. And therefore, given the very sensitive nature of the discussion we need to have, my request that it's in public, that it should be in private, ba'aznei Adonai, so that we can discuss things candidly, and I won't risk my life by being right. So this is the approach of the Rosh HaKodesh to the opening of Vayigash. Yosef, as a result of Yehuda's plea and other circumstances, v'lo yachol Yosef lesapek. He can't restrain himself any longer. And he tells them that he's Yosef, and they reunite, and it's very emotion-laden. And then he says to them, in Perek Mem Hei, and the Perek has begun with V'le'yochol Yosef Lisapek, and in Pasuk Dalet, he says to them, Ani Yosef Acheichem Asher Mechartem Masi Mitzrayma. I'm Yosef. And then he says in Pasuk Hei, Ve'ata Al Te'otzvu. And now, don't be sad. Va'yicha Be'eneichem, don't be upset or angry. Ki Mechartem Masi Heina. Ki Lemichyosh Lachan Yelokim Lefnechem. Because it was really for, ultimately, for the good, for life. As he proceeds to say in Pasuk Vav and Pasuk Zion. And all, in the end, it all worked out. And he reiterates this in Pasuk Ches, Va'ata lo atem shelachta mosiheina, even taking things to a further level. Ultimately, it wasn't even you. Ki ho elokim, it was all min hashamayim. That means a lot when it's Yosef who said it. The brothers said it, so then that's a quick comfort. But Yosef himself is saying it. Ki ho elokim, and it all worked out. And again, the Rechaim HaKadosh notes this expression, Va'ata. Because translated linearly, Va'ata, and now, it sounds like we're moving on to a new topic. It sounds like it's a new discussion. And now let's come to talk about other matters. What he proceeds to say is not other matters. It's the same thing. I'm Yosef. Please don't be sad, don't, etc. It's not a separate topic. There is only one topic that day. That's the fact that he's Yosef. Everything else is commentary. And the Or Chaim HaKadosh is sensitive to this word, Vata, and now, because it really sounds like we're moving on to other things. Are we? It's the same thing. One could perhaps have said, Vata, maybe we are misled by the English usage of the word. And now means, doesn't mean a new thing, but just a new point. But to the Rechaim HaKadosh, it sounds like it's really a new topic. That's the standard usage of Va'ata. So what does it mean? If we consider further, in Pasuk Kafhei, when the brothers go up to tell Yaakov, in Pasuk Kafhei of Perek Memhei, Vaya'alu Mitzrayim, Vayavo Eretz Kanan Yaakov Avihim, they came to Yaakov, Vayagidu lo lemor, O Yosef chai, V'chihum Moshel be'eretz, b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, Yosef is alive, Vayofo glibo ki lo emin lahem. And he didn't believe them. The Pasuk says he didn't believe them. And then, Pasuk Kaf Zayin, Vayidabru alav is called to pray Yosef, Asher Diber, and they told him everything Yosef said, Vayares ha'agolos, Asher Shalach Yosef Laseso. So he saw the wagons, but there's a very well-known comment to Rashi about that. Agola, Eglarufa. Vatechi Ruach Yaakov Avihim. And then his spirits were revived. That means in the space of one Pasuk, he went from not believing them to yes believing them. What changed? Aside from the Agolos. The Pasuk says, they said to him everything Yosef said. That means that saying Yosef is alive, he didn't believe them, which is amazing. He did not believe them. Until they told him what Yosef said, and then he believed them. What was it that Yosef said? Is it, shall we say, verification per se, and now there's just enough evidence? It could be something else. The Rechaim HaKadosh says, the word Va'ata is a very pivotal word. It means a now, because in a sense it introduces the question of what do we do now? And what does that mean? Yosef has just revealed his identity finally to his brothers. He's Yosef. So he knows it, and they know it. There's just one person who doesn't know. That's Yaakov. And the question is, what are they going to say? If they're now planning strategy, to go up to Yaakov, how could they possibly broach the subject without condemning all of them? And that's it's an amazing understanding of this word. Va'ata means, what do we do now? What do you tell Yaakov when you go back? It's a new question. Says the Rachaim HaKadosh, tell him what I'm saying now. Tell him that although it looked like it was a very dark episode, it was being governed from much higher on, to the point that I am prepared to say it wasn't even you that sent me here. Ki ha'elokim, it was Lemichya and Lachayos Amrav. That is the only way that Yaakov will be prepared to accept that any of this happened. Because if it's just you, you'll be finished. That's Va'ata. So Va'ata are not Yosef's words purely to the brothers to make them feel better. It's Yosef's words. This is what to tell Yaakov. So that if he shouldn't never have anything, want to have anything to do with you again otherwise. And the Chasam Sofer, continuing this theme of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, says, this is exactly how it played out. Because you see, from Pasuk Kaf Vav, when they said Yosef was alive, Yaakov didn't believe them. Why didn't he believe them? Says the Chasam Sofer, he didn't believe them because he couldn't afford to believe them. Because if he believed them, then that means that all of his sons did what they're now saying that they did, and he could not bring himself to believe that. And he stalled. Vayofog libo. He didn't want to hear it. And then Pasuk Kavzayin says, Vayidabru elav es kol divrei Yosef. They told him everything Yosef said. What? Everything? Including what? Says Chasam Sofer, including that message. That they weren't the ones that sold him. This is a message from Yosef. Look what's happened. It's clearly Bederech HaTeva, he would have been dead by now. If he's second in command in Egypt, there's a higher force governing, and therefore that needs to be taken under advisement. And that is what allowed Yaakov to accept it, and then ultimately to accept that Yosef was alive. Atechi ruach Yaakov aviyah. So these are very interesting insights into the events of the beginning of Parshas Vayigash. Now, Yaakov goes down to Mitzrayim, him, his family, and they're mentioned by name. The original Shivim Nefesh, well, 66, plus the three in Mitzrayim, plus one. And in Perek Memvav, Pasuk Yud, there is an amazing Rashi, sourced in the Medrash. We are discussing B'nai Shimon. Who are they? U'v'nai Shimon, Yimuel, V'yamin, V'ohad, V'yachin, V'tzochar. Okay, those are the five sons of Shimon. V'sha'ul ben HaKenanis. And Sha'ul, the son of the Kenanis. Now that obviously is somewhat discordant. Who is this Sha'ul ben HaKenanis? And why is he called that here? And Rashi says, it's from the Mebrachus Rabbah, ben HaKenanis, who is this Kenanis? Says Rashi, ben Dina. He is the son of Dina, this Sha'ul. Shenivel al Kanani, she was taken by a Kanani. That's Shechem. Except, but then how does this Sha'ul come to be listed with the sons of Shimon? Kishahargu es Shechem, lo haisa Dina rotsa loseis. When they killed everyone in Shechem, the only one left was Dina. And she didn't want to leave. She was overcome with shame. None of it was her fault. But, as we know, that doesn't stop her being ashamed. Ad shenishba la Shimon sheyisaena. Shimon, in order to save the situation, he will restore her honor, and he said that he will marry her. And the son is Sha'ul, and she is the Kenanis. Now, all of the Mefarshim and all of the Poskim are very intrigued here, to use an understatement, because they're brother and sister. Now, what's amazing is, just to appreciate the angle of the background here, why is Rashi quote this Medrash and the Canaanis, the pshat of Canaanis couldn't be simpler. I mean, someone who comes from Canaan. It sounds like she's from Canaan, says the Mizrahi. But Rashi takes one look at the word Canaanis and says, well, that can't be. How could that be? After all, hasn't Avram, if there's one thing they've learned from Avram, isn't it not to marry from the daughters of Canaan? And that's what Avram said to Yitzhak, and that's what Yitzhak said to Yaakov. And one of Yaakov's own children would marry a daughter of Canaan? Impossible. Inconceivable. Okay, so who is it? It's his sister. In other words, that's the good news. That's how it's not so bad. But of course, it's worse. So how is this the solution to everything? And we should know, and important to phrase it this way, because although, of course, at a first glance, it sounds to be one of those questions which is, well, is it not true that the Ovis kept all the mitzvahs and the Torah says that a person can't marry his sister and therefore how could it be? It is that, but it's much more. And the reason why is because as far as the halacha is concerned, the iser to marry a sister is also forbidden for Bnei Noach. Now, the fulfillment of Tariag mitzvahs on the part of the Ovis and the Shvatim may have been voluntary, but the fulfillment of Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach is mandatory. And therefore, if we find that Yaakov marries two sisters, which is none of them are his sister, that's something that the Torah will forbid in due course. And we understand that the others elected to keep Taryag. How do we deal with that? And the Mefarshim discuss it. That's a question of Taryag. This is not Taryag. This is Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. So how can it be? I must say, before we embark on the Derech HaMelech of this question, it's not so well known, I think, that the Bartanura, who is famous, of course, for his commentary on the Mishnah, also has a commentary on Rashi's Perush on the Chumash, called Amar Nakeh. And the Bartanura raises this question, and he draws our attention to the fact that he saw manuscript version of Rashi's commentary, according to which there is no problem. Namely, our version of Rashi is, most versions, is that Dina didn't want to come out, and Shimon, Nishba la Shimon sheyisaena. Shimon said, he will marry her. She said, no one's going to want to marry me. Shimon said he'll marry her. And then, of course, that leads us to problems. How can it be? They're brother and sister. Says the Bartanura, in the version of Rashi that I saw, the concluding words are, Shenishba la Shimon sheyasi eno. There's an extra yud. Our version is sheyiso eno, which means that he will marry her. But I saw, says the Bartanura, sheyasi eno. Sheyasi eno means that he will marry her off. Not that he will marry her, lahasi. And therefore, it doesn't mean that he himself will marry, but he'll find someone suitable for her to marry. That's what he undertook. But there was no issue of brother and sister. Her son, because he undertook the achrayus to marry her off, becomes connected with Bnei Shimon. So says the Bartanura, according to that, and that's important to note. Having said that, most versions of Rashi, and of course we need to be compared with the Medrash itself, read Sheyisaena, and how do we understand that Shimon could marry Dina? Now, there is a question that has become very widely discussed, theoretically and also practically, and it relates something that has only recently become a possibility. Namely, the concept of surrogate motherhood, whereby the ovum, right, the egg, comes from a woman who perhaps is unable to carry to term. It's removed from her, transplanted into another woman who does carry it to term, and thus is the baby born. And assuming that is acceptable and permissible if conditions are right, the question arises as to who is the mother? Is it the donor, the genetic mother, shall we say, the one from whom the ovum comes? Or is it the mother who bore him? Who bore him into this world, the mother, the gestational mother? The premise of the question, of course, is they can't both be his mothers. Which some people actually do not discount. We would say as a matter of intuition, you know, a person can't have two mothers, but that's only because no one ever has. But could it be a person can have two parents? Most people do. So maybe they can have three parents. Could it be a parental relationship with more than one woman? Possibly. But on the assumption that it's either one or the other, without any discussions about having more than one Jewish mother being a problem all on its own. So who is the real mother? Now, as we can appreciate, this was not a question per se that was discussed, not in the Gemara and not in the Shulchan Aruch. But one could say that the closest one could come to a proof from the Talmud comes from a fascinating case to be found in Maseches Yevamos, in Daf Tzadik Zayin, Amud Beis. And some argue that this is the definitive source for the ruling on this matter. What does it say there? As we know, when a person undergoes gerus, so they become born anew. Ger shenis gayer, kekotan shenolad. They sever all family ties that they had until that point. Okay. If a woman, therefore, converts, she is considered to be not related to anyone that she was related to before. Even if an entire family converts, they're halachically, strictly speaking, not related to each other. Of course, for many, many reasons, they will not begin to marry each other, but strictly speaking, family ties are severed. Now, what happens if a woman is expecting as she undergoes gerus? So what is her child? Is he also Jewish? When she comes out of the mikveh and the child is born, is he also Jewish? The answer is, he absolutely is. Except the question is, why? Is he considered also to have converted? Are we saying two people have converted? He converted before he was born? Could it be? Maybe he's considered to be part of the mother, and therefore it's just one entity that's converted. The question that the Gemara deals with is, what happens if a woman is expecting twins? And then she converts. So when those two children are born, what is their status vis-a-vis each other? After all, we say, Gershinis Gayer, Kekotan Shenolad. When a person converts, all family ties are severed. So them, these two children, having undergone conversion in the womb, when they're born, are they considered to be related to each other? And the halacha is, they are. With everything that goes with that. They are considered to be, if they're two boys, they're brothers, they're two girls, they're sisters, fully. Now this is very interesting. Because if we say that the relationship is set by the ovum, the eggs, that is, then they may have been originally connected to each other, but as they undergo gerus, their relationship should be severed. And if it is, then what brings them back together again? How can they be born as brothers? They're in a highly unusual situation because they have been considered like born anew before having been born at all. They are the original Kekotan Shenolad without having been Nolad Klal. And yet they are born as brothers. And what does that tell us? That tells us that the family connection is set as they leave the womb. Because if it were set prior to that, then through the gerus it would be severed and they would not be born as brothers. The fact that they're born as brothers means that regardless of what they have undergone prior to that, they are considered to be related to each other. And of course they're related to each other through the mother. Certainly they will be considered to be related through the mother. That relationship is set at the time of birth. And based on this, there are those who say that the woman who bears the child, she is the mother. Now, this, of course, has been discussed widely over the last few years. But we should know that one of the sources that discussed this question wrote about it a few hundred years ago, even before it was possible. And that is the Tor. The Tor, who is famous, of course, for the Arba Turim, the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, and he's also known as the Bala Turim. There's a very well-known commentary on the Chumash, the Bala Turim, which has many gematrias and many things like that. those gematrias were originally written as the prelude, as the introduction to the Torah's Perush. He wrote a full Perush on the Chumash. And at the beginning of the Parsha, he wrote gematrias on the Psukim. So in the course of time, and through someone's decision, or I'm not sure who he consulted, the gematrias became so popular that they actually siphoned them off from the actual Perush of the Torah and printed them as a work on themselves, and it actually became unknown that the Torah had a Perush on the Torah, because the Balaturim is the gematrias. And then his Perush on the Torah was printed in a separate volume, and it's called the Perush HaTorah HaOruch, the long Perush of the Torah, where its real name is the actual Perush of the Torah, because the Balaturim is not yet his Perush. In any case, and the Torah actually is a digest of the opinions of Rishonim in very, very terse form. It's amazing how he was able to condense it in that way, Rashi and the Ibn Ezra and Ramban, and of course his father, the Rosh, and himself. And within the context of that Perush, we return to our question. Our question was, Shimon, Dina didn't want to leave. Shimon said, he'll marry her. Nishbar Shimon sheyisa ena. And how can it be, brother and sister? Now the truth of the matter is, for the sake of accuracy, this question needs to be qualified slightly. Because the halacha, as it happens to be, is that the prohibition for Bnei Noach to marry brother and sister, specifically as brother and sister through the mother, but not through the father. In many respects, when it comes to Bnei Noach, the halacha lays more emphasis on the maternal relationship than the paternal relationship. And the problem of brother and sister is the problem if they're related through the mother. Okay, that actually doesn't help us. And the reason why is because they both have the same father, Yaakov, and they both have the same mother, Leah. However, says the Torah, if we go back to Parshas Vayetze, in Perek Lamed Pasuk Kaf Aleph, as Leah is bearing the Shvatim, Perek Lamed Pasuk Kaf Aleph, we will find, and this is the birth of Dina. So what has the standard way that Leah's childbearing is described in the Torah, you can see it in all of the Shvatim, is Vatahar Vateled. She conceived and she bore. Vatahar Vateled. And then we come to Pasuk of Aleph, and it says, Va'achar Yolda Bas. And then she bore a daughter. And it's very interesting, without loading too much into the question, the Pasuk, when it describes her bearing her sons, says, Vatahar Vatelet, she conceived and she bore. And when it comes to her bearing Dina, says, Yolta Bas, where did Dina come from? Well, actually, the Targum Yonus of Menuziel discusses this. It's a well-known, the background is well-known, that so far, Leah has 6 children. Bilhah and Zilpah have 2 each, and Rachel has no children. And as Leah conceives, she was expecting another boy. Except if she actually bears this her 7th son, and all of the Imahos know that there will only be 12 Shvatim, there will only be 1 Ephes, and it will turn out that Rachel will have less even than Bilhah and Zilpah, and that will be a terrible busha. So she davened that should not be the case. Here she is, expecting a son, and being Leah, she's able to do this. The Gemara says, do not do this. There's not really much you can do about it. But for Leah, she davened that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should intervene. And he did. Says the Targum Yonus of Ben Uziel, the Ichlefu Ubarayhu. At the very same time, Rachel was expecting, but Rachel was expecting a girl. And the two became switched. According to the Rabbi Yonis ben Uziel, the very first embryo transplant took place between Leah and Rachel. and neither of them felt a thing. Says, and that explains to us why when it comes to Dina, the pasuk doesn't say Vatahar Vatelet Bas. It doesn't say she conceived and she bore a girl, because she didn't conceive a girl. She bore a girl, she didn't conceive a girl. Now, how does that help us? Says the Tur. Now we have a very interesting Shaila. Because, according to Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, Dina was conceived, actually, by Rachel. And born by Leah. So now let's ask a Shaila. Who is Dina's mother? Says the Tur, there is room to say that Dina's mother, significantly, is Rachel. And because that's true, Dina and Shimon are not considered to be brother and sister from the same mother. Because Shimon was born by, his mother is Leah. Dina's mother is Rachel. Now, of course, they have the same father, but for Bnei Noach, brother and sister from the same father is okay. The problem is the mother. They don't have the same mother. So this is the Tur based on the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. That's his approach to explaining this problem. And we should know, by the way, because now that we're sensitive to this issue, as the Pasuk describes Yaakov's children as they go down to Mitzrayim, let us see, Perek Mem Vav, Pasuk Tes Vav. From Pasuk Ches of Perek Mem Vav, it's been describing the sons of Leah, Bnei Reuven and his sons, and Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zebulun. And that's from Pasuk Yud Aleph to Pasuk Yud Dalet. And then, Pasuk Tes Vav, Eile Bnei Leah, these are the sons of Leah, Asher Yoldo LeYaakov B'Fadan Aram, Ve'es Dina Bita, and Dina, his daughter. Now, Rashi already notes, because you can't fail but notice, that we're all talking about the children of Leah. And the six sons are called Leah's sons, and as Dina is mentioned, she's called Yaakov's daughter. She's not Leah's daughter? It's Dina Bita? Says the Ponim Meiros of Meir Eisenstadt in the Sefer Kotnos Or on the Torah, according to Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, we understand very well why, as much as she naturally accrues to, and is grouped together with the other brothers, certainly if she's married to Shimon, that may well be. But the Pasuk doesn't call her the daughter of Leah. The Pasuk calls her the daughter of Yaakov. The sons are the sons of Leah. She is a daughter of Yaakov, according to Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, because she's not a daughter of Leah, certainly not in the full sense. And the matter goes further, because there is a klal that is to be found, recorded in the name of the Vilna Gaon. Family connections are described in two ways in the Torah. Sometimes they say atzmenu, right, we have the same bone. Sometimes they say besarenu, we have the same flesh. What's the difference between them? I mean, together they make up the human being. Says the Gaon, based on a Mishnah in Maseches Nida, which tells us that it's the father that gives the bones and that part of the makeup, and the mother that gives the flesh and blood. And therefore, says the Gaon, we understand that whenever two people are related and the relationship is called they are have the same etzem, it's because they are related through the father. And when they're called the same basar, it's because they're related through the mother. They have that in common. Is it a bone relationship or a flesh relationship? Now, if they have both parents in common, it will be both. Generally speaking, one only gives the other. There was only one time in history that one person gave both. And that's Adam Arishon. Because Chava was the first person to come from only one person. From Adam. And he says, Zos hapam, Etzem me'atzamai, u'basar mi'bsari. This is it. This is a one-off. That both the etzem and the basar will both come from me. From here on in, it's male and female. Okay. And in fact, that's what Lavan says when Yaakov comes to meet him in Parshas Vayetze, Ach Atzmi uVesari Ata, Atzmi and Vesari were related through the father, related through the mother, which they are, as if to emphasize how close he feels to Yaakov, which is why Yaakov should start working for him immediately. There's one problem. There's one pasuk that stands out in light of all of this. In Parshas Vayeshev, Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Kaf Zayin. Yosef is in trouble with the brothers. He's in a pit. And Yehuda rescues him. At least to sell him on. Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Kaf Zayin. What does he say? We can't kill him. We won't gain anything from killing him. Rather, let's sell him to Ishmael. We can't be the ones to finish him off. He's our brother. He's our flesh. Asks the Mari Asad, Rabbi Yehuda Asad. Just one moment. This is Yehuda talking to the brothers. And he describes Yosef as Achinu Bisarenu. Now, according to the Vilna Gaon, when someone's Bisarenu, that means that you have the same mother in common. Yehuda is the son of Leah. Yosef is the son of Rachel. He should have said, Atzmenu. We have the same father, but they do not have the same mother. Says the Mari Asad, this is the other side of the coin. As surely as Rachel was originally expecting Dinah before she moved into Leah, Leah was originally expecting Yosef before he moved into Rachel. And therefore, in Kenim Hadvarim, if it is indeed true that the woman who the ovum came from is the mother, then it turns out that it was appropriate for Yehuda to say about Yosef, Achinu b'sareinu. Yosef emerges also as a son of Leah, Ad Kedei Kach. So these are very compelling points that come out from the parsha. Huh? Blue Daihatsu, keys in the car. Lopo. La Halacha. What do we say? The question was asked to Dayan Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak. And the first response, which a halachist has to give, is after all of this, who is the mother? And it's Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, and it's the Tur, and it's the Ponim Meiros, and the Mari Asad, says the Posek, Dayan Weiss, Ein lemeidim min ha'agodas. Everything we've said so far is in the realms of Agoda, and the Yerushalmi says in Maseches Peah, you cannot pass on halacha based on Agoda. And the reason why, as the Maral explains in the Be'er Agola, is because in order to derive a halacha from a statement of Chazal, it needs to be analyzed in light of every other statement, and questions are asked and answered and challenged and defended and worked through. But the truth is, ultimately, when it comes to a statement of Agoda, you can't pass on a halacha because you can't critique it. You can't ultimately even ask a kasha on Agoda, because to ask a kasha, you have to have been sure of your definition of what the Agoda is saying. But we never know if the Agoda means to be taken literally for its halachic import, or to communicate a message of Yiddishkeit, but not necessarily to sign on the bottom line of the halacha. And that's why the Yerushalmi, actually, before it says Ein lemeidim min ha'agodos, you can't learn halacha from Agoda, it says Ein meshivin al Agoda, you can't ask a kasha on Agoda. Says the Maral, anything you can't ask a kasha on, you can't pass on a halacha from, because you can't even begin the process that would yield the halacha. And therefore, the halacha will have to come from the halachic areas of Torah, either the issue of Gerus, as we spoke about, or beyond, perhaps, but not from here. And moreover, says the Minchas Yitzchak, we should know that the Gemara in Brochus, at the end of the ninth Perek, has already discussed this, has itself discussed this. And the Gemara gives a somewhat different ending to Rabbi Yonasan ben Uzziel. But the Gemara says she's called Dina because she was the product of a diun. She dona leya din ba'atzma. She began a procedure of discussion, dissertation. How can it be? I'll have seven sons, and then Rachel will only have sons. But she's expecting a son, and Rachel is expecting a girl. What will happen? Now the Gemara, something happened. What was that something? Says the Gemara, as a result of her tefillos, something very unusual happened. And that is that although she was expecting a son, it became a daughter. Beyond the stage where the gender was set, which of course why a person could never daven for something like that. But she did, and it happened. And although Rachel was expecting a girl, the girl became a boy. And therefore the transition, according to the Gemara, wasn't that they were switched, but each one changed. If that's the case, says the Minchas Yitzchak, we now have two versions of what happened. All we know is that originally one was a boy and one was a girl, and by the time they emerged, they were different. But we don't know, did they stay the same, but the geography moved, or did each one undergo a change within themselves? And now, says the Minchas Yitzchak, even if you could paskan the halacha, we would have to discuss the question as to which of these understandings is the normative one, lahalacha, lefi the agoda. And certainly that's something that's very difficult to do. And that being the case, we reluctantly, for all of the psukim that it illuminates, but we need to act responsibly in terms of basing the halacha, which may have other factors and there may be other meanings, and thus it was left for the other areas of Shas. But this is certainly a fascinating discussion with regards to this matter, which is halacha lemaisa, and comes from the Parsha. Just one final comment that comes as Yaakov is going down to Mitzrayim. Or perhaps if we've already begun to discuss Rachel and Leah, I'll mention in conclusion something that I saw in the writings of Rav Hyman Zatzal, and it relates to, it brings us back to the beginning of Vayigash. Yehuda, he steps forward. Why? Because he has undertaken responsibility for Binyamin. He's the Orev. He is the original Orev. Anochi e'ervenu mi'adi tivakshenu. Therefore, he cannot leave Mitzrayim without him. So that's a historical undertaking that on the part of Yehuda. And in the end, Binyamin came back. Or Yaakov was at the very least reunited with Binyamin. What's fascinating is, according to the Medrash, the connection between Yehuda and Binyamin did not end there. Not only did the connection not end there, but the relationship of Arevus, of Yehuda's responsibility towards Binyamin, was not a one-off. It's an amazing thing. For there is a Yalkut Shimoni in Shmuel Aleph, which discusses the standoff that existed between Goliath and the Jewish people, their army, which was headed by Shaul HaMelech. And no one could answer the challenge of Goliath. And there he was, terrorizing them and insulting them. And says the Yalkut, Lomot oso shevet lios orev elu le'elu. Yehuda has a history of stepping in to protect Binyamin. Shene'emar anochi e'ervenu. As Yehuda originally said, I will protect Binyamin. Amar Yishai leDavid beno. So Yishai says to David, as he sends him out, Hare hashor shetelech v'tekayim osa areva sheYehuda zikancha. You have an achrayas, which your Zayda, Yehuda, undertook, she'iriv es Binyamin miyad aviv, to take care of Binyamin. Shaul is from Binyamin, and he's in trouble. You need to help him out. That's the family Masorah. Me'asa David, halach v'kiyem es arevas v'haragas Goliath. So David went, he had killed Goliath. He's looking after Binyamin. Amazing, that's hundreds of years after the original Chiyar Benu. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, chayecha, k'shem shenasata nafshecha tachas Shaul, you placed yourselves, your life, at bay for Shaul, shumishiv tshuv shel Binyamin, just like Yehuda did, kachanino sein beis hamigdash bechelek Yehuda u'Binyamin. The reward of David HaMelech is that the Beis HaMikdash was shared in territorial terms between Binyamin and Yehuda. In principle, the way Moshe has said is Bein Kasef of Shechem, it's said to Binyamin, he's Yedid Hashem, Bein Kasef of Shechem. Somehow, a good deal of the Beis HaMikdash is in the territory of Yehuda. It's shared. Now, why is it shared? That is the compensation that Yehuda gets for taking care of Binyamin. And moreover, as Rav Hyman points out, the word Arev, which we say is a guarantor, is also connected to the word arev in the sense of mu'urav, of mixed in together, of connected in that way. And the reason why, of course, is that when you undertake to guarantee someone, so then much of what they have accrues to you. And therefore, because Yehuda protects Binyamin, so the Beis HaMikdash that accrues that is in the chelik of Binyamin, part of it goes to the chelik of Yehuda. And moreover, as Rav Hyman points out, that's the level of, or the stage of ta'aruvus after the level of arevus. And when it comes to the destruction of Amalek, which in initial terms is in the domain of Yosef, when Yosef is born, as Rashi told us, right, Zara shel Esav falls into the hands of Yosef, Beis Yosef is Lehava, and Beis Esav is Lekash. But David is the one who has stunning success in terms of battling against Amalek in his time. And moreover, once again, we see the Taruvis in Mordechai, which is our historical confrontation with Amalek. And Mordechai is descended, he is Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini. He represents the fusion, once again, of those two kochos, because they both partake of the ability to do battle with Amalek. What originally began with Yosef as Zarah shel Rachel, more correctly, right? Zarah shel Rachel, and is also finds its way into the domain of Yehuda. In fact, historically as well, as we know, Shlomo HaMelech says that Kadosh Baruch Hu tells him that most of the Jewish kingdom will be taken from him. He'll be left with one shevet, and the Radak says that one shevet is Yehuda and Binyamin. He was only given one Shevet, and the two of them together ultimately are considered such a fused entity that they're considered to be one Shevet, which happens to be true. Their Nachlos are together, and they represent southern Israel, Kohanim, Yehuda, and Binyamin. And this is the full fusion that is the fruits of the original guarantorship of Yehuda, which set in motion a historical relationship that continues until our time. I'll leave it over here.